and welcome to Blogosphere Serious Influence, the podcast all about the business side of the influencer industry. I'm Alice Audley, and I'm the founder of Blogosphere. We run events, an influencer network, a magazine, and now a podcast too, which I'll be presenting. If there are any questions about the influencer industry that you want answered, be sure to tweet us your suggestions. Our Twitter handle is @BlogosphereM. Today on Blogosphere Serious Influence, I'm joined by Jennifer Quigley-Jones, who is the founder and CEO of Digital Voices. Digital Voices, which launched in 2017, is a YouTube-first influencer marketing agency. Jenny launched the company after working within the YouTube team at Google and has worked with clients including the Post Office, Surfshark, and Trainline.
Thank you very much for having me. My name's Jennifer Quigley-Jones and I am the CEO and founder of Digital Voices, which is a YouTube specialist influencer marketing agency based in Shoreditch.
So tell me a bit about your background. What was your education? What's kind of led you to where you are now?
So at school, I was a bit of a geek. My friends were known as Jenny and the Losers. I used to wear punk boots and multicoloured tutus. Pretty weird. On the weekends.
Okay.
It was an all-girls Catholic grammar school with purple uniforms. They really weren't fans of individuality in any way. So
how did you find going to all-girls school, like competition-wise?
Really academically intense.
Yeah.
And girls will like rip people apart sometimes. I mean, that was my experience in school.
Yeah.
But I was always very, I became really focused on academics when I was like 17. So then I went to Warwick and did history and politics with a year in America. Was really interested in Middle East policy, so did my master's at Harvard on in Middle Eastern studies, so Arabic every day, and it was funded by the Kennedy Memorial Trust, which was a scholarship that sent British students to Harvard and MIT. And then after working on the Syria crisis for a while, I worked at Oxfam for a little bit. I found that my Arabic wasn't fluent. It was good, but like it wasn't great. And I really wanted to learn as much as possible in my next like career step, because NGOs like move very slowly. And I read an article in The Economist that said, if you're quirky, go and work in tech. So I applied for a job at YouTube and ended up working with UK creators as a partner manager at YouTube for 2 years.
What year was that you started then at YouTube? And how difficult was it? What was the interview process like with that? Because don't they have multiple?
Yeah, it was quite intense. And I started in 2015 and stayed to like mid-2017. The interview process was while I was in Boston. So you had to like do phone interviews. I applied for a role in Arabic working with Middle Eastern creators, but from London. And they made me interview for an hour in Arabic just on like, so on Skype, basic Google Hangouts, but with no video. So you're just sat there talking to someone, and I had like post-it notes with Arabic words all over my screen. It was a nightmare. They were like, you're good, but you're not fluent in multiple dialects. I was like, yeah, of course.
Wow.
Okay. So there were two phone interviews, including that one, and then three separate interviews via Google Hangouts with different people. They asked if I could be in the UK for those, so I went into the UK for those and did them all in one day. But it was quite an intense process.
So you got the job?
Got the job.
And based in London. What were your responsibilities then? In 2015, that was the first sort of outdoor campaign with YouTubers.
Made for you. Yeah, that was 2016. They did the buses 2015. It was a really exciting time. I think the job has changed a bit since, but at the time when I first joined, they wanted us to work with like over 100 creators a quarter.
But you got to build direct relationships with influencers through that.
Yes, and often their management would turn up to meetings, but most of the time it was you and the creator. And that was amazing. Like that, I think I worked out once and there were like 500 creators in 2 years, which in the UK space means you're getting to know the people who are across all different verticals who are growing and not necessarily really big. You had to have like initially 10,000 plus subscribers and then they raised it to 100,000 plus. But it meant you got to know all this like talent on YouTube, especially the people who weren't ready to be full time yet, which I really enjoyed because you're helping them like shape their careers.
Do you think that maybe you wanted to go into management for a period of time after doing that?
Management is very stressful and there are a lot of really bad managers.
What makes a bad manager?
God, you're asking the hard questions, aren't you? I think people who aren't honest with creators, who aren't open about fees. So if anyone's taking more than 20%, run away. I think bad managers also would take AdSense revenue. There are also those managers who run around claiming to manage people that they don't actually have relationships with, and I think that's awful. If you're anywhere near exploitative with young people, again, I think that's an awful sign. But also I think some talent, like management, then forces you to really force them to professionalize. And a lot of YouTube creators aren't ready sometimes to step into that consistent business professional behavior space. And I think they're pushed by managers who know they need to accept brand deals to earn fees. So I just never wanted to be someone taking money off creators. Our entire like business model now at Digital Voices is that we will take money from brands. We're never taking them from creators.
So what made you want to sort of leave Google? Was it burnout from meeting so many creators in such a short amount of time? Or did you feel, I mean, YouTube, there has been quite a lot of backlash with it then deprioritizing digital first creators and working more on celebrity?
Yes. There was a debate about that while I was there. And there were lots of reality stars that were coming to us, TV stars coming to us, like asking for strategy. And I wasn't particularly interested in them, to be honest. It's fine. It's just not, it takes so much skill to be a YouTube creator. You need to be able to edit videos and have your own style and do it consistently. And it's very different to Instagram. To be honest, after 2 years, I just felt like I was having the same conversation with creators and I wasn't learning. And at the same time, so many brands were coming to our team and YouTube wasn't supposed to be matching up brands and creators. So many brands were like, can we sponsor anyone? Could you provide a list? And I was like, well, this isn't our job and we're not impartial. So I felt really strange because you're like half recommending people, but you're not seeing the brand deals through. And there was obviously a huge gap in the market. So it's kind of, yeah, a combination of getting bored and not learning. I think YouTube and Google are a great place to work for a couple of years, but they take really smart, high achieving people and put them in jobs where they often do the same thing. So unless you really are committed to staying at Google, you can break those structures and like find new ways to innovate within Google and move forward.
So the impetus to start Digital Voices was because nobody was sort of doing the video piece. Do you do campaigns across, Instagram as well, or is it you predominantly look, this is video, and why in your view is video so much more important than the other channels?
Yeah, we do YouTube first campaigns. So we've done Instagram campaigns, but they're with YouTube creators. They tend to have higher engagement rates on Instagram anyway, because when you're scrolling through just a vast amount of content, you will like someone if you feel like the like means something or you're actually friends with them. If you feel close to someone, you'll engage with their content more. And YouTube creators just have such a deeper relationship with their audience. I think it's, to me, the prime difference is you are watching someone for an average of 4 minutes of video with the sound on. You have a search process before you choose to watch that content. So they have to really earn your trust to get watched. And then once you do, you're like full screen, sound on, immersive viewing, and you pay attention for like 4 minutes. And the average view time on our campaigns is 5 minutes, 17 seconds. For a brand to get access to someone for that long, they would have to pay to like commission a short documentary on TV. Like people don't pay attention for that long on other platforms. And that's why I find it so exciting.
Facebook video, what are your views on Facebook video?
I think Facebook has always prioritized publishers and that is great for them, but it has led to a lot of publishers having issues. And I think also people, it's a similar scrolling thing. When they're scrolling through Facebook, they're not watching it. The average watch time on Facebook video is like 17 seconds. And if you talk to most publishers, they're like, we get nowhere near that. And it's sound off viewing. So it's not the same type of experience. And think about like the number of people who watch YouTube like in bed. Like you don't get into bed and watch Facebook. You get into bed, watch Netflix. You get into bed, watch YouTube. How many platforms do you let into your bedroom?
And you use YouTube as search as well. So you're searching for things which you don't really do on the other.
No, not at all.
Platforms.
I think it's a very different approach to video. So we have debates because often brands will come to us and they'll say, right, we know we have to partner with YouTube creators to access young audiences. So there's this like stereotype of like Gen Z YouTube viewers. So if you want to partner with someone who has high subscriber numbers, consistent views, great. But I also think the search functionality on YouTube helps you access older audiences. Mm. Think about like the number of people who, when they're redoing their house, search for like how to build this brick fireplace thing But I think search attracts different people, but it's still super powerful for brands and they need to learn how to use it.
In terms of the clients that you work with, is there a particular vertical that you see more of approaching you? Is it sort of beauty, fashion, or?
We've worked with people from like music to fashion to tech to travel. I think the vertical that's most excited is weirdly any product that needs the sound on to explain. We're doing a really big campaign with Fast Hosts at the minute, who are a web development platform. So if you have a business, you can buy your domain or manage your website or manage your emails through Fast Hosts. They're partnering with like technical creators. We're working with a VPN company at the moment and running Surfshark's campaigns. And they partner with people across every vertical, but it's because you can't explain it via an Instagram post. You need the sound on to explain it. So I think there's a lot that we're going to do much more in tech, much more in travel, much more in fashion. We've just signed a trial with a fashion brand, which I'm really excited for.
Would you ever consider doing some campaigns across podcasts? Because in the same way that you engage with a YouTube video, you do engage with the podcast more, and you have your own podcast as well, so...
Yes.
What was the reason for starting that?
I think we just realised that there are a lot of stereotypes and negative stereotypes about YouTube creators, and you really want to break them by showcasing like the creative and entrepreneurial talent out there. I think YouTubers get a really bad rep for no reason often, like, or there's one person who behaves badly, Suicide Forest, and everyone gets tarred with the same brush. So we wanted to showcase the weird careers people have had and the weird channel specialisms. We interviewed like Colin, a broadcast whose entire channel is about traveling the world and haggling at fake markets. Hilarious, great, really weird. Over 1 million subscribers, like, great.
I mean, going down into a niche, engaging with content as opposed to just eyeballs on it, do you still find that we're in an industry that is about these sort of vanity metrics? Do you think that that is sort of undermining the space?
Yes. I thought it was massively last year, and this year I think brands are getting a bit more savvy. It still is interesting when brands are like, how many impressions can I get for this, or how many completed views, and it shows they completely misunderstand the space.
What would you say to a brand when they ask stuff like that to you?
It's like comparing apples and orchards. Like, an impression is literally someone flicking past an image. It is nothing to do. You don't even know if they've read the caption. But a YouTube video where they have to listen to your branded message for 30 seconds, as well as often like a dedicated video, and they watch about your brand for 5 minutes, massively builds trust. So normally the way we will show that how different it is comment sentiment. So we get really good comments. Two social media teams have had to send around the definition of the word stan to their team, which is from the Eminem song, your biggest fan, stan. And like, I mean, Post Office's social media team never thought that they'd have audiences say, I love you so much that I'd kill my girlfriend if you reject me, which is kind of hilarious. So we show them positive comment sentiment. We've also got to the stage where we're doing time spent with brand as a metric, which is really compelling. You can show a brand how many years worth of time the audience viewing that campaign has spent with your brand. We're also doing performance-driven campaigns that are based on conversions. We have a client on a retainer where if we do not make back a certain percentage of their spend within 30 days in actual sales, they can end the retainer.
Yeah.
And they've just upped it to unlimited.
Great.
Because it's done so well. So I think like you can really, people should be really focused on tracking ROI, whether that's through like UTM links or discount codes or landing pages. Yeah. Like, you can definitely track conversions. And I think in 2020, there's going to be a huge push towards, right, what did this campaign actually sell?
Is that technology that you built out, or do you?
We get the creators to share the analytics with us, and then we work it out from there.
How old is Digital Voices now?
2 years, just over two years.
Yeah. Do have the sort of niche within it, but there are multiple agencies. How has the reception been? Do you find that agencies are kind of warm and welcoming to each other? Do you find that they're very competitive? What are your kind of views on other agencies within the space? Are there people doing it well? Do you think there are some people that are not doing it so well? Do you think we'll see consolidation?
I think finally we're at the stage where there are so many of the maybe more blustery players have fallen away, and like random management companies trying to like tout talent have fallen away because they can't compete in that type of media buy performance-based marketing world. I think in the last year and a half, things have professionalized quite a lot. There are like the business of influencer dinners, and there are people who are trying to bring agencies together. And I think I'm more than happy to share knowledge. Like, I've been on panels. I'm like happy to like chat. I like that we have a specialism that demarcates us as different, because I think especially with the branded content from Facebook and Instagram, platforms and agencies that are really just relying on measuring Instagram are really going to struggle. And I think they're probably going to try and pivot quite quickly.
Yeah, I think a few of them have already and sort of got a higher tier where they actually do the brand campaigns and work directly with influencers, which is sort of the antithesis of what the platforms were supposed to be doing in terms of scalability.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that, I mean, I think it's a good thing that they're trying to pivot, but also it shows a slight desperation. I think TikTok is the other one. Everyone keeps trying to pivot to like, oh, we have this search functionality for TikTok creators. And TikTok is, I mean, pricing standardization wise is ridiculous at the moment. And also, if a brand owns their content and they own their channel, that's fine. You've got to be so careful with like the challenges that are created on TikTok.
From a brand safety perspective.
Yeah, I mean, there was so many issues around this with YouTube, but YouTube spent 10 years trying to fix it. TikTok,
they've got 1.5 billion monthly active users now,
which is huge. Like, the scale, that's like massively overtaken Instagram. It's very addictive to use. The user experience is great. Yeah, YouTube's on 2 billion, Facebook's on 2.2, I think.
I know Facebook's 2.7. I have to try and pull those stats. What are the analytics like that you get with TikTok, though, as a brand?
The API isn't open and they're trying to build more analytics. I think brands, before they spend like a lot of effort or decide to do TikTok, I think it's like in vogue at the moment, should definitely spend time on the platform. Like, the more time I spend on it, the more concerned I get. Like, there's a challenge which is like hashtag I don't look thick till I turn around. And literally a young TikToker was saying to her audience, please 13-year-old girls, stop doing this challenge. You're putting basically like borderline child pornography on TikTok. And the whole point of the challenge is you stand as a girl facing the camera wearing leggings, and then it says, I don't look thick till I turn around, check. And then you turn around and put your ass in the camera to show that you're thicker than you look. Like, there was a side profile challenge. What is that as a quality of content apart from trying to sexualize young girls? Like, it's literally awful. And the comments on them are so many old men commenting on these young girls. And I'm like, we need to be super careful about that. So we're happy to work with some TikTok creators if it's part of a YouTube first campaign. But I just think brands need to be super wary.
When you were at YouTube, was brand safety one of the big concerns? And did you sort of follow what some of the mechanisms they put in place for that was? Because I know that there was the removal of ad revenue and pre-roll on the adpocalypse, etc. People are saying that they're seeing a return though in pre-roll revenue again now.
Yeah, it's coming back. I mean, the thing when I was there, my big concern that I flagged, and a lot of people flagged, there was an article about the child content that was being viewed in a sexual way that wasn't necessarily sexual content involving children. That was concerning. I would sit down with creators and be like, hey, you know this video where your daughter is in a swimsuit in a bath of slime, 25% of the viewers are from non-English speaking men who are aged over 40. How do you feel about that? And it was just a really interesting conversation to have, because often these creators know what they're doing. And they'll be like, don't worry, my child's safe because it's only a video and it's not actually inappropriate. And so I think it's like YouTube had this big issue where they're trying to work out whether you can control viewer behavior or viewer mentality, and it's really difficult.
Do you think YouTube offers the best sort of insights as a platform? And we've talked that the API isn't sort of open for TikTok yet. We've had a few people that have companies that are based on Facebook's API and it gets cut off overnight. What are your...
Yeah. I'm hoping YouTube doesn't cut off access. So I said they'd limit it. I think the more Facebook plays this game where they limit access, YouTube will look at limiting access as well. And I think that's kind of the wrong way to go about it. Not just selfishly, because we use the API to pull creators based on their audience data. But...
Why do you think Facebook is doing that with the API? Do you think that, you know, we've had the removal of likes recently, or that's being rolled out, and that there's the Facebook kind of creator portal, and will that become basically the biggest influencer marketing platform? Not to be too skeptical of sort of mental health.
I agree. Assertions. I 100% agree with you. I think it's Facebook trying to own the ad spend. This is one of the things I find really different, again, about YouTube and Facebook. YouTube has made videos for 10 years. I mean, they've commissioned originals, they've experimented with stories, reels. But like, apart from that, they've pretty much been a video platform. Facebook has released Facebook Dating, Facebook Currency, like, is trying to own pretty much any spend they can. And that's why I'm kind of more skeptical, because I agree with you. I think they're trying to own the influence marketing spend through owning the metrics. Is that what a platform should do? There's a question mark there, right? Like, I don't know if that's the money or the space they should be in, because it's essentially limiting entrepreneurship on the entire industry around influence marketing, but also limiting the control of influencers themselves over their data. Like, they might choose to sign up to one platform, but if Facebook is the only platform and is automatically showing their data to brands, is that concerning? I mean, I'm quite skeptical of it.
Bit of a minefield.
Yeah, it is. I mean, I like the fact that YouTube's been doing video for 10 years. It's growing, and there are new creators on who are just like completely different to the people who were on the platform 5 years ago. And I love that they're sticking to that specialism.
Do you think that YouTube should be doing more for their creators, though? Because you do get quite a lot of creators that are a bit annoyed at YouTube, specifically. You know, you see the YouTube Rewind and it's all based on Will Smith, and then not being on the trending page and things like that.
I think YouTube needs to expand its partner program, because it's become much more limited in that they wanted to help support creators more deeply. So since I left, they started restructuring it. So partner managers work with the same people over and over again, which is great for the level of support they get, but it also means it's inaccessible to a lot of creators. So we've sent creators to the YouTube partnership team with over 1 million subscribers. And they've been like, oh, I don't think we have space in our portfolio. And I'm like, this creator is growing really quickly. They're amazing. They're a young BAME woman. This is essentially what you're supposed to be promoting. Who talks about mental health? I'm like, this is someone you're supposed to be promoting, who you want to be supporting, who you want to represent diversity on your platform.
When brands come to you and they're asking for recommendations of influencers to work with, is diversity one of your big kind of thought processes when bringing campaigns together? And do you think enough people are doing that?
We do it quite naturally, because our team is like very racially diverse and gender-wise very evenly split. I think it automatically imbues your campaigns with that. I did have to sit down the post office and I was like, are you a bit worried we don't have a man on this campaign? They were like, no, it's okay. So normally, and we've actually had another brand we ran an event for, they were like, this is the most diverse event we've ever seen. I was like, great, cool. Mm. It just happened naturally.
Yeah, which is the best. We ran a panel at the Blogosphere Festival. It's actually available on the podcast as the last episode of series 3. And it was saying that, you know, you can't just as a brand, be like, I'm going to be diverse now. It has to be internal. It's who you're hiring. And then that's the only authentic way to be diverse, which makes perfect sense.
We have this YouTube session every week where on Thursday afternoon the team will get together and we show each other the YouTube channels or formats we've discovered that week. And one of the new members of the team was like, oh, I've just been watching this like lace frontal wig tutorial. And the guys on my team were like, what? And I was like, you know what, we're going to sit down and watch it and you're going to show them, because back hair's huge on the platform and it's something they'd never been exposed to. And they just couldn't believe. They were like, millions of views. Mm. And I kind of feel like by knowledge sharing with a diverse team, you're educating everyone.
What's the best campaign that you've worked on as Digital Voices that you're most proud of to date?
That's tough. I think probably it was not a big campaign, but it was so much work. So we did a campaign for Post Office Travel, and it was to promote the Travel Money Card and travel insurance, which has to go through two legal teams of compliance, the insurance team and the Travel Money Card team. And they were really worried about accessing young audience. So like finance and insurance, very stressful topics. And we sent one creator to do a £100 challenge in two countries in 24 hours. So she like traveled from Poland to Berlin. It was really cool. And it was Click for Taz, who is hilarious. She's one of my favourite creators to work with. And then we sent Eve Cornwell, who was a law student. So with the compliance stuff, was amazing, to Porto when she finished her exams. And they both did this like cheap break with very smartly integrated branded messages. But throughout, it was a lot of fun. Click for Taz made this joke out of it, like, oh, if I fall over, I'm fine because your girl's got travel insurance. And people kept commenting like, your girl's got travel insurance in the comments. And it just really resonated with the brand. So I loved doing that one.
What are the worst campaigns, not that you've worked on, but that you have seen across the market? What do you think is like a systemic bad influencer campaign that's perhaps what's tarnishing our world?
We refuse to work with any gambling or tobacco companies, and that includes vaping. I am so angry anytime an influencer promotes loot boxes or promotes a gambling platform. I don't care if when they click through to the link, it says, are you over 18? I don't care. Because essentially what you've done is taken your audience that you know includes young people and you know you cannot age gate and promoted gambling to them. And you've endorsed it. So you as like a YouTuber who like 4 in 10 millennial subscribers say their favorite YouTuber understands them better than their friends. You can extrapolate that that's gonna increase with younger viewers. You as a trusted person have decided to use that trust to recommend gambling as a way of life. And that is awful.
Are you seeing an increase in people promoting gambling?
We've literally been the CEO of another influence marketing agency when it came out that we refused to work with gambling or tobacco products. Sent a crying with laughter face to my Instagram, like messaged me like, how, that's hilarious. We've been told by multiple agencies to just take the money. Agencies are influencer specialists.
Gotta have values there.
Better to have values. But the thing that amazes me is clients don't ask their agencies, who do you work with? Do you work with gambling? Just ask as a client. It's your responsibility to make sure you're working with people you ethically agree with. And it amazes me that people don't do it.
Especially when you've launched your own company, you want to be able to stick to your values, but you've also got payroll like to think about.
Turning down the big brands that we did was really painful. You see the amount of money, and that's how a lot of influence marketing agencies as well also prove their models in terms of conversion. One of the reasons I'm so grateful we got to work with Surfshark, and we've done I think over 100 videos with Surfshark like in the last 6 months, millions and millions of views. It's been really exciting. I've been so happy we could prove our conversion model with a product that is not gambling.
Yeah.
Because we can sleep at night. But yeah, it's, I get that when you're growing a business, that's what you want to do. But I could never not think about the societal cost of what we're doing as well. And I wouldn't want to use influencers as pawns or financially incentivize them because they need to pay their bills from gambling money. Like, it just feels evil. And for vaping, loads of people like, vaping's fine. Once someone vapes, they are 4 times more likely to smoke.
What are your aspirations for digital voices? Like, would you like to set up offices all over the world? What's your sort of next 3 to 5 year plan?
My plan is to become the global authority on YouTube creator marketing. So hopefully it will expand that quickly. I think we're probably going to open an Amsterdam office in the next 6 to 8 months. We just won booking.com. So we're working with them, seeing how that expands. And we're in talks literally this afternoon with a big brand based in Amsterdam as well. So very excited about that. We're running a campaign in the Middle East at the moment, and I think there's a lot of opportunity there, and I kind of want to open an office there to kind of like go back. And I think Singapore's on the cards as well.
Where would you open the office in the Middle East?
Probably the UAE. I used to live in Kuwait, but I think probably the UAE is good because it's closer to the media. Lebanon's great, but it's a bit unstable, so UAE probably. There's a lot of potential there. I think there are lots of YouTube things happening in the UAE.
So will you be looking then to hire some more? Will you be growing your team this year as well?
Yeah, we're already desperately trying to hire more creative strategists. So we're massively hiring. We hired 4 people before Christmas and we're hiring 3 now as well. So in the last 2 months, it's just got pretty crazy.
How do you go about your recruitment?
We experimented with a recruiter before, but we found that they didn't get YouTube. And so it's really tough. We are going to put the jobs on the dots and on the drum recommends, and maybe on campaign we'll decide, because we're trying to hire an agency specialist first, basically someone who knows YouTube and the agency ecosystem, because we have so many relationships with agencies where we just don't have time to follow up and close the deals.
Because I suppose that's another sort of side tangent, that you have created a business as a female founder, as another female founder over here. How have you found that process?
I started by myself and I didn't realise what running a business would be. And then now it makes me just want to win more. That sounds really bad, but I realise how few female entrepreneurship role models there are. Especially in an influencer space where there are so many influencers that are female, creators that are female. I can't believe that there aren't that many female founders in this space. So it makes me really want to be a really good example. And it makes me want to win in a business sense.
Yeah.
I don't just want to be the person running an influencer marketing agency that's fluffy and be like, oh, Jenny did that nice business. I don't want that. I want, like, we guarantee views for every campaign. We guarantee conversions when that's in the criteria. We win. We outperform everyone.
How does the guaranteed views work?
Guaranteed organic views based on our predictions.
What happens if you don't hit that?
We will either return our agency fee to the brand or we'll spend it commissioning content until we do. We're very honest about it. We would never tell creators how much they're expected to hit. We would never put it in contracts because that incentivizes them buying views.
Yeah.
Which we don't want to do. So we essentially are like 70% of the fee goes to the creators. Can write that in contracts as well. The 30% we earn if we get the data right. If we don't get the data right, we haven't earned it. You can have the money back.
How important do you think that level of transparency is across the space? Do you think we'll see more of that this year?
I hope so.
Yeah.
Someone in the industry said to me, oh my God, your customers come back. You've got people who want to put you on retainers. Shout about that. And I didn't realize how many agencies in this space struggle with consistent clients because we've built our whole business on consistent clients who come back that we work with for like minimum a year. I think if you're not keeping your clients, you're doing something wrong, and it's often because you're not transparent enough and you're not honest enough. If we think something's going to not work, we'll tell them. Or if we think the fact that we put our money where our mouth is as well means they trust our creative ideas more.
Yeah.
So that's quite fun.
And finally, what are your predictions? I mean, we're in a new decade. It's 2020. What do you think that we're going to see in the whole influencer marketing world?
Hopefully time spent with brand as a mainstream metric. I think we're going to see far more management. There's still a huge gap for management. And I think we're going to see more management companies spring up that actually work with deep niches. So if you look at like educational or study tuber management companies, I think like 16th Talent have done a lot with study tubers. Maybe there'll be more specialist management agencies come out. I think we're going to see creators diversify even more. One of my employees found a channel the other day. It's a YouTube channel with 50,000 subscribers where the guy reviews lift journeys.
Yeah.
He gets in, listens to music, gets out.
What are you most excited about?
Oh, can I also add the death of the Instagram grid? Actually, maybe that's what I'm excited about. No, it's not. Death of the Instagram grid is a massive prediction. I think if you look at the way TikTok is so engaging, it's like very immersive, full screen, swipey user experience. I think Instagram is just going to kind of try and copy that as much as possible.
What about IGTV?
I've just talked about it for so long and it's not been engaging yet. Everyone's talking about making IGTV content.
Originally, when IGTV was able to be shared to the feed, the reach on that seemed very good, but that seems to now have been restricted.
Yeah, and it's also like, okay, if you only watch it when you're scrolling, does that mean IGTV should exist or is successful? Not necessarily. It means, like, they don't release watch time, I think, for a reason. I mean, we'll keep talking about IGTV probably for the whole of the 2020s. I'm most excited about building the team. I don't know, working with more creators, like running more campaigns, being more creative. We're about to launch some campaigns I'm really excited about. Got so many brands getting in touch who are super interesting to work with and are desperate to do something different or like long form with influencer marketing. We had a brand the other day say, yeah, we want to do YouTube, we just don't want to run YouTube ads. Can we do something really like meaningful with creators? I'm like, yes.
Yes, we can.
Let us do it.
A big thanks to Jenny for coming on the show.
You've been listening to Blogosphere Serious Influence with me, Alice Audley. For more influencer industry updates, be sure to check out www.blogospheremagazine.com. And why not invest in a subscription to our essential magazine whilst you're there?